Yesterday, I was at a Canada Day celebration at a lovely cottage on a lake, and as often happens at these events, I found myself standing outdoors with the husbands, hovered around the barbecue with arms folded and beers in hand. And as the conversation inevitably drifted to matters surrounding work, it astounded me to hear how these men, many of whom work in your typical corporate structures, talk about a work culture based on fear and a systemic avoidance of creative ideas. Fear of the unknown, fear of falling behind, fear of losing even a percentage point of market share, and the sacred reliance on any idea possible, so long as the idea isn't new and untested, or, heavens and shareholders forbid, a creative idea. And so, as often happens at these events, I don't typically reveal that much about the kind of work that I do. But in this situation, it was interesting to speak to the fact that in my world, in the non-profit world of cultural ideas, this fear that they spoke of hardly exists. We are not typically afraid of our competitors in our world. We may be envious and jealous of them at times, but more often than not, we admire them and benefit from their success. So it was a nice little bit of peace of mind to contrast with the fact that I make 5 times less than these other fellows do. Hi there, I'm Sean Devine, and this is my second thought residency. Call me old-fashioned, but I've always believed that live theater was invulnerable to the social contract, which maintains that the act of theater, the art of theater, is something that's ultimately respected from both sides of the stage. I'd often pose the question, when was the last time you were at a live theater production where a member of the audience got up on stage and intentionally interrupted the show? For me, the question was rhetorical. It never happens. But either I'm just naive, or that time is coming to an end. In the last 2 days, I've heard about productions where audience members walked onto the set of a Broadway show to charge their cell phone, or heckled performers at a show in Los Angeles, only to have the actors get into a physical altercation. It seems that theater itself is reflecting our current civilization that's falling more and more into upheaval with every passing day. Crazy times ahead, but I wouldn't lean too heavily on that fourth wall. Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and here is my third thought residency. When it comes to the ongoing battle of form versus content, I often find I'm on the losing side. Like how the dinosaurs must have felt when they saw those pesky mammals crawling out of the evolutionary soup. Now, I love the process of creation, and the creations I've been creating of late seem to be more and more complex, and so the process behind those creations is proceeding in a similarly complex fashion. But how many times, as my collaborators and I weave our way through what it is we're trying to create, as we engage in complex debate on the nature of what we're doing, as we put our thoughts up on chalkboards or demonstrate our intentions through eclectic gesture, how often does one of us scream out, this should be the show. What we're discussing now, this conversation, this is the show. It's like a conversation in a diner between Jerry Seinfeld and George Costanza, proving yet again how advanced they were for their time. Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and this is my fourth thought residency. 2 days ago, the New York Daily News printed an article with the headline, "Theater actors are getting angrier at their audiences." Is that true? Are we getting angry at our audience? And if so, why? We're angry when they don't show up. We're angry when they do show up, but they don't behave in the manner that we expect them to behave. We're angry when they don't applaud. We're angry when they give standing ovations that aren't fully deserved. We're angry when they use their cell phones, even though we give away free tickets for people to do live tweeting during our shows. We're just so angry at the audience, even though we are desperate for new ways to engage with the audience. When Rome was burning, everyone got mad at the guy who delivers the wood. Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and here is my fifth thought residency. So I'm driving in the car, and we're on the way to our family vacation, and my wife is reading the latest draft of the play I'm writing, and she likes it, and she says, I love this play. It's such a well-written play. And I'd like to feel just complimented by that, but that term resonates in my head, the well-written play, because I often hear that term, but in a pejorative sense, as if the well-written play has gone the way of the dodo bird. And it just strikes me as, for people to consider that the well-written play, good storytelling, to be passé, to be something of the past, be something to be like poo-pooed on, that's like saying, I want to buy a new house, but I don't want a house with direct sunlight. I don't want a house with good light. But it does remind me of how fearful I can be as an artist when I consider that, am I an antique? Am I not in the fast lane anymore? Because I remember writing a grant for one of my plays. And this was soon after I heard that criticism of the well-made play. And I went back through my grant and I selected each time I had written the word playwright in the grant. Each time I'd referred to myself as a playwright, and I took it out and I put in the term theater maker, thinking that that was a safer way to get my grant. And so sometimes I can't tell if I'm a talented artist or a useless idiot. Thank you. Hi, this is Sean Devine, and here is my sixth thought residency. So here's another entry from my travels on the road. But it's nothing. There's nothing like driving through small towns to remind you of the vibrancy of theater. As I've been driving through Quebec and New Brunswick, and now PEI, every once in a while I would see a sign for this summer theater here or that stock theater there, and it, you know, mattered enough that there's even, you know, an official highway road sign to indicate that the theater is nearby. And I was leafing through a magazine, The New Yorker, and there was this one of those cartoons they had. In the cartoon, it depicted a bunch of people, obviously, at an outdoor summer theater festival. And the caption for this cartoon said, every time I lose faith in humanity, then along comes Shakespeare in the Park. And that was another, you know, depiction of theater in small rural areas. And it just is very comforting to see how it thrives there. Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and here is my seventh thought residency. So my friend and I are creating a new play, a new project, and basically the project is about how humanity can create and sustain utopia. And one exercise we gave to ourselves was trying to come up with what we thought were 15 essential roles for a new society. We challenged each other to come up with 15, and it was actually quite hard to come up with 15. And obviously we came up with the obvious, the doctor, the farmer, the educator, the carpenter, and all that stuff. But we each noticed that we put down some form of artist, whether it was writer or performer or something like that. But they were definitely near the bottom of the 15. They snuck in there at around 13 or 14 or so. And there we were, two artists, finding it hard to justify our very existence in the new utopia. But as we then had to, you know, rationalize why the artist was there, it wasn't necessarily to entertain. Not at all, but as we tried to rationalize what was the essential role of the artist in society, in a new utopia, it came down to just how we thought that that person wasn't just the chronicler of society or the one who might inhabit all of our roles, but it was the person who would hold the mirror up to ourselves, the mirror that reflected society. And we thought that was pretty cool that once the Armageddon comes and we're all trying to get on the spaceship for the new colony, that there will be a role for us somewhere. Hello there, this is Sean Devine, and here's my eighth thought residency. I think I can be a very hard guy to work with. And I think that often comes down because I overthink things. I put the cart before the horse. I fail to buy in to the notion that the process is more important than the result. I think it's that buy-in, that failure of buy-in, where if I know, or if I think I know what that end result is supposed to be, I structure my work trying to keep that in mind. And I fail to remember that buy-in, to just accept that premise, that let it be. And I remember an exercise in clown class back in theater school where this really, really came to light. In clown class, we were assigned an exercise. Go up on stage as a clown and try to fix the bicycle. Try to fix the broken bicycle. And of course, we all know that the clown, because he or she is a clown, cannot fix the broken bicycle. And so I would, rather than just do the exercise, I would say to my teacher, so I guess the point of this is that I'm not able to fix the bicycle. And the teacher would say, shut up, just go up there, clown, and fix the bicycle. And I'd say, okay, so you just want me to fix the bicycle? Yes. So I would go up as a clown, and I just fixed the bicycle. And it was easy to fix. And it got fixed. And I failed miserably. So I got really confused, and maybe that's why I'm hard to work with. Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and here is my ninth thought residency. When I was in theater school, one of my favorite writing exercises that we had was when our teacher would have us do a writing assignment where we had to write non-stop, without editing, without censoring ourselves, without stopping for a second for, let's say, 10 or 15 minutes. We would just have this pad of paper, and the teacher would say, go, and we would go. If you ended up writing the same word 12 times, fine. If you started talking without even knowing you were talking about it, that you were talking about embarrassing things, fine. If you were making fun of yourself or your family, fine. Just write without stopping. It's really interesting. A lot of the stuff, most of the stuff that came out of that was crap, but, you know, it was very freeing. Now, here I am today. I'm working on this new show, and we are writing as we go. It's a piece, it's a collaborative piece. And I'm at rehearsal today. I'm at our workshop where we're creating it, and my computer breaks down. Doesn't work. Can't reboot it. I can't turn the computer on. And we are just about to do a 15-minute writing exercise where I had to sit and write a monologue nonstop for 15 minutes, and my computer doesn't work. And my automatic assumption is, well, I can't do the exercise because there's paper there and there's a pen there, but it's been about 10 years at least since I've written with pen and paper. What's that got to say about me? Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and here is my 10th thought residency. So today I started reading Jordan Tannehill's book. I think it's called Theater of the Unimpressed, and I'm only on page 20, but it's very exciting so far. But he's talking about where theater must go if it needs to survive, at least according to his opinion, and his opinions are very, very, very potent. But he talks about how theater must exist in a form that it can't be anything else other than done in that live environment. And if the theater that you see can be done in any other environment than that live environment, it simply won't cut the mustard. And he also goes on to talk about how the cult of the well-made play is holding us back from getting to that new theater. And here I am. I've just finished my latest well-made play, and right now I'm working on another play which is not at all that kind of form. It's a collective collaboration. I'm barely writing anything, but I've just finished this well-made play, and it's one of my better well-made plays. It's got tight action, the storyline is really, really taut, the dramatic arc is there, the characters are sparring, the dialogue is awesome. It's really a well made play, and I'm sending it off to this theater company in America, and I know they're going to do it, and they're even going to try to get other companies to do it, And I'm reading this article going, yeah, I just sent off my ticking time bomb, my well-made play for you to produce. And I can't help but think that I just sent off the last of a mighty dinosaur. And I'm just going to watch that mighty dinosaur walk their last steps and then fall when the glacier comes. Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and here is my 11th thought residency. So, I've been thinking about some friends and colleagues of mine in Vancouver who have been leading the charge for the diversity in theater movement, and they're getting a lot of good work done. And the challenge that they're up against, as the entire country is up against, is that the theater scene is not accurately reflecting the cultural demographic that exists on the streets. So, fast forward to an audition I have in Montreal yesterday, where I'm auditioning for this TV show, and I'm auditioning for two parts. One part is a recurring role where the character will come back over multiple episodes, so it's a very good financial gig. That character is just of a cop. The other character is of a bartender who breaks up a bar fight, and the bartender role is really just one scene, one day of work, not a very big money gig. So I do both auditions, and without sounding egotistical, I nail both auditions. I do exceptionally well. And I can tell I do exceptionally well because the director is nodding his head emphatically, pointing the finger in the "you're my guy." But in the back of the room, someone from the network is not nodding their head enthusiastically. I find out later that although the director wanted me for the recurring cop role, the network did not, because according to the network, I do not look like the cop that they want. There were two other people that they wanted ahead of me, and those two people, the director told me, were, and he kind of just gave that, better looking description. So I lose out this role because there's two better looking people for this cop. I get the bartender role. Later on that day, I have to go to a rehearsal for that bartender role because the bartender role involves a fight in a bar, and so, we're fighting. So we go to this real bar in East End, Montreal. It's a dive. It's the diviest dive bar. And we're staging this fight scene, and inside this dive bar are some real customers of this bar. And there we are. We start practicing the fight. But myself and the stuntman, we practice a little bit too aggressively, and so we actually knock over a couple tables and a couple chairs. And these two customers, not knowing perhaps that what we're doing is just faking a TV show, these two customers get up and they start screaming, how dare you disrupt what we're doing? They come up and they're in our face. And I'm looking at these two customers thinking, nobody could ever find two customers that look as perfect as these two people right here. They're real, they're genuine, they are reflective of the cultural demographic that is on the street. They are ugly as sin, and they're perfect. And I'm thinking, if those two customers had been characters in this episode, they would never have been cast. Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and here is my 12th thought residency. So I was reading this really, really good article in The Guardian the other day, and the article was about how we are approaching the end of capitalism, how we are entering the post-capitalist age. And in this article, the writer was making some references to Shakespeare and to some other playwrights and in how they encapsulated the spirit of the age. Now, this author was also defining capitalism as the age when scarcity created the marketplace. And I think this person was saying that during the pre-capitalist, during the feudalist age, when there was the great black plague that wiped out entire swaths of population, there became a scarcity of laborers. And so that scarcity of laborers and that scarcity of resources and food and all that led to, value-added systems which created capitalism and blah, blah, blah. And then this writer was talking about the post-capitalist age. And the writer was saying that perhaps in this post-capitalist age, there will not be a need for playwrights. And so I started thinking about that. And I was thinking about how Somebody I respect in Vancouver was once talking about how we are entering a post-literate age, a post-linear narrative age, and I was thinking of myself as a playwright saying, well, that doesn't sound very good. And I was imagining that if here we are, and maybe the playwright came about, maybe the writer came about because there was a scarcity of original stories. The average Joe and Jane on the street couldn't create their own story. We yearned for it, so we created the writer, we created the playwright. And perhaps in this post-capitalist, post-literate age, there is such an abundance of stories, such a surplus of narratives, that perhaps we don't need the playwright. Perhaps in this post-capitalist, post-literate world, rather than going to see a story or listen to a story, we'd prefer to stand around a glowing orb which projects light, and we can infuse all kinds of meaning onto it as we imagine. We, the audience, can become the narrative, and the glowing light can become the art. And I thought, if that's the direction we're heading in, that doesn't sound too far from the cavemen and cavewomen who sat around their fires eons ago, watching the glowing fire and projecting their own imaginative narratives onto it. So maybe we're just coming full circle. Hey there, this is Sean Devine, and here is my 13th and final thought residency. So, I like to fancy myself a political theater artist, as dorky as the label sounds at times. I like to think that the theater I create and the community building that I engage in helps to make a difference, helps to have an impact politically and socially on the world that I live in. But I often wonder, you know, does it lack impact? Is it inconsequential? And then I think back on something my friend Marcus Youssef said when he did a keynote address at an event in Winnipeg, when he talked about how theater, due to its very inconsequential nature, the inconsequentiality of theater makes it infinitely more powerful. Because when you are inconsequential, you are free to say the boldest, most dangerous thing. You can speak the inconvenient truth. And so I think back on the role of the court jester. And who is it that can say the most damning thing in the court but the court jester? So recently I decided to throw my hat into the political ring. I've decided to make a stab at it. And I can't help but think back about a play that I wrote and produced and performed in a few years ago in Vancouver. It was called Except in the Unlikely Event of War, and in this play, I myself, Sean Devine, the playwright, was a character in this play. Obviously, it was very meta-theatrical. And this playwright, Sean Devine, the character, he himself wanted to be more political. And there was a monologue that I delivered in which I read off a list of playwrights who had in fact become politicians. There's numbers of them, numerous ones of them. And in this list, several of these playwrights who turned politicians were in fact assassinated. So, this is certainly not a death wish, not at all, but I do hope that if ever I cross over from one to the other, that politics can be just as brave to speak inconvenient truths as being an artist can be, as being a playwright can be. So that's it for now. I hope to continue engaging with all of you in many, many more impactful ways.